Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's web seminar, Child Welfare and 2011 Realignment. My name is Amy Lemley. I'm the Policy Director at the John Burton Foundation, and we appreciate you taking your time today to participate in today's web seminar. We were laughing this morning that it comes at kind of a hard time for people who are involved in legislative activity as the legislature winds down and not exactly winds down, but considers legislation. So thanks for taking time to participate. We're very pleased today to welcome over 160 registrants to today's web seminar. And before we begin, I want to take a moment to review the process for participating. So after you registered online, you should have received an email with a link to the webinar. And when you click on that link, you should now be able to view the slideshow. To hear the audio portion of the webinar, there's a number on your screen, that's 626-544-0058, and then you enter an access code, 869-162-933. Now, we find that often the most interesting parts of our web seminars are the questions that you ask, and so we want you to submit them as you think of them. There's a question panel on the GoToWebinar information panel. Just send those to us. Some people have asked, does everyone see them if I send them in? But they don't. It just goes to the moderator, that's me, and we will make sure to answer as many as we can today because it's a lot of great content. We're very excited to be presenting this. So today's web seminar is a continuation of a conversation that many people across California have been having for some time, and it's an ongoing look at 2011 realignment. So as I'm sure many, if not all of you know, this fundamentally changed how we finance our child welfare system here in California. And so today's web seminar, we're going to continue our investigation into that change, and we're going to divide that look into three different parts. First, we're going to hear from Isaac Menashe, who will present the findings of his report on 2011 realignment. Isaac is a policy analyst with California Covered, where he provides technical assistance on legislation, advises senior leadership on internal policy, and engages partner agencies and stakeholders to support the mission of the Health Benefit Exchange. Prior to joining California Covered, Isaac worked as a researcher within the California Budget Project, analyzing child welfare services realignment, which is where this analysis originated. He also spent several years working to advance policies that support immigrants, as a paralegal with the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project, and as a policy analyst with the California Immigrant Policy Center, where he coordinated successful legislative coalitions. Isaac holds a master's degree in public policy from UC Berkeley, go Bears, and when he is not riding the train to Sacramento, he is working on policies to convince his daughter to eat more vegetables. So after Isaac presents the findings of his report, we're going to be joined by, first, Reed Cannell. Reed is the Executive Director of the Alameda County Foster Youth Alliance, which has been forging a path forward of organizations working in coalition to understand realignment and to try and devise strategies to kind of operationalize it locally. And then following Reed, Martha Matthews, attorney at Public Counsel, will be joining the web seminar. Martha is doing organizing efforts in Los Angeles to, again, understand the implications of realignment in that large, complex, multi-layered county. So they're going to help us take kind of the information that Isaac presents and bring it to the county level. What does it mean? What's the process we can go through together, be it advocates, be it community-based organizations, be it county representatives, to think through this fundamental change and have it be the most productive one possible for vulnerable children and youth in California. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Isaac, and we'll be joining you in a little bit. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Amy. It's really my pleasure to be here with all of you to talk a little bit about realignment. And you know, our agenda for today is just to talk about, first lay out some of the promise and the risks of what was realignment in 2011 and how does it change our the way we finance child welfare in the state. I look a little bit at three areas of analysis that I think stand out. One is first about funding. How do we allocate the money? How much money is there? Second, county flexibility. What will counties now do with the flexibility that they have? And then third, how does realignment impact the potential evolution of the child welfare system going forward? And then finally, I have a few recommendations which I'll actually intersperse throughout the presentation, and then we'll hear from Reed and Martha. So just to skip to the next slide, what was realignment? Governor Brown announced it as a vast and historic realignment of government services in order to ensure that local needs are met in the most sensible way and to allow governments at all levels to focus on becoming more efficient and effective, facilitating services to be delivered to the public for less money. So the basic premise is that we change the incentive structure to encourage efficiency, and that will enable us to deliver the same quality services for less money. And to be honest, you're probably asking yourself, well, who's this guy Isaac and why is he interested in child welfare? And I need to let you all know that I'm not a child welfare policy expert or a practitioner. I don't have experience in the practice, but I came to this issue because realignment, what's happening in realignment is symptomatic of the governor's approach to addressing budget problems across the state, and I had several years of experience working on the budget and during my graduate work focused on the state budget, and this seemed like one of the pickles that had gotten very little attention but is fundamental to thinking about what's the future for financing public programs in our state in the going forward. And this is, you know, the patterns that we see in child welfare realignment are now spreading to other parts of the budget. So that's actually how I come to this. So I look forward to our conversation in the Q&A and for you to help give me feedback about how my analysis resonates with what you experience on the ground. So the implicit benefit of realignment is also that if you have flexibility, counties will be able to innovate new ways of designing their programs and delivering services. So the promise of realignment was that you have a dedicated revenue stream. It's tied to the sales tax and the vehicle license fee revenues, and therefore you're out of the cuts and the struggles over the general fund. So that's a potential benefit. The flexibility is freeing up counties to do more innovative programming that Title 4E and other funding restrictions when there were matching rate formulas prevented counties from being able to experiment and deliver services in a new and more innovative way. And then finally, for system evolution, you know, if we have, the governor didn't say this, but implicitly, if we have kind of 58 laboratories for how to do child welfare policy, we have the opportunity to learn a lot more about what can work and spread those innovations throughout the state. I think, but going along with these three areas of promise are risks. So in funding, is the level of supply adequate? And how equitable is the distribution of funding across counties? In the real core, I think, is in county flexibility. How do we know that count, will the new incentive structure push counties to or enable counties to structure their programs and meet their balance their budgets by aligning best policy practice with the new fiscal incentives? And so there's a real question about whether the fiscal incentives are going to be aligned with best practices. And then finally, with system evolution, you take away a lot of the control at the state level, and you spread it to 58 counties. We really want to know, well, are all voices going to be represented at those 58 counties as budget decisions are being made? And then secondly, are we experimenting without being able to learn and to propagate the new learnings of the different things that are happening in the 58 counties? So these were some of the risks that I identified that really stood out to me, and so my analysis, it really asked in each of these areas, how does the structure that realignment implemented, does it contain adequate safeguards, and how does it mitigate these risks? And I should just mention that this presentation is based on a longer paper that I think Amy has circulated and is available for you. You can always get in touch with me, and there are more details there. There are lots of citations because I like citations, so you can check out any of this analysis in more detail. Just to quickly look at the recommendations, and I'll go through these during the presentation, but I've got two in each category related to making sure that we consider whether we need criteria in the way that funds are distributed, considering the use of a trigger on the reserve account. This has to do with revenue volatility. There's the importance of public reporting for realignment to so that we have a way to know what's going on in counties and to assess what the effects of that are. And one way we could do that also is through strengthening the system improvement plans. And then finally, in the area of system evolution, there's importance for the to remember that the legislature still has an oversight role here, even though child welfare is now largely out of the general fund. And then finally, the important role of supporting county stakeholders, and that one's particularly directed at those organizations that are that you know are capacity building and foundations, and those who kind of track that there are enough resources throughout the state. So, looking at the funding allocation. I said that realignment creates a block grant for child welfare essentially because it gives counties a set amount of money to for the state portion of their funds to spend as they will. So how is child welfare funded? You all know this, of course. It's a mix of federal, state, and local sources. Important to keep in mind the distinction between discretionary programs and mandatory expenditures because that has new importance under a block grant or realigned funding scheme. And then equally important that the distinction between funding sources that require a match and those which are, oops, there's a typo, but it's, you know, that a block grant is where you get the amount of money and you spend it in order to meet outcomes. For those of you who want the details on how the sales, the dedicated sales tax revenue and vehicle license fee are structured, that's in the report. But essentially, child welfare services will now be funded, as I think all of you know, through this direct revenue stream. So the growth in funds available for child welfare are tied directly to the growth in sales tax revenue and in the vehicle license fee. There's the role of federal financing is still important because, you know, for counties that need to draw down federal funds, all the 4E funds, those who don't have 4E waivers, those funds still need to be matched by the federal government. And so there's some limit there on how much flexibility a county has because you can't just switch to activities that are not 4E eligible and then you won't be able to draw down those federal funds. And so in this new funding scheme, as I was researching this issue, I heard a lot of fears about the funding. So foremost, and Amy actually highlighted this for me, is you know what does the combination of a set block grant amount of money, no longer receiving a matching rate in state funds for child welfare services, how does that intersect with the gradual erosion of 4E eligibility due to the look back? And then a second area of concern is the inadequacy of funding, and finally the equity of the distribution. So let me turn to those three questions in that order. So first, you all are familiar with this, but fewer low-income Californians are eligible for Title 4E funding each year. And so on this chart, you can see the orange line shows 100% of federal poverty, and the gray bars just show what percentage of federal poverty you needed to be at that particular year in order to qualify for 4E funding. So in 1996, it was about 125%. Now it's just over 85% of federal poverty, meaning that, you know, and we see this in the data, that fewer and fewer of the children in the child welfare system are able to draw down federal funds. If you have under realignment, if now your state portion of your state funding is set based on a formula and not based on your caseload, and you are receiving fewer and fewer federal dollars for kids, then it really raises the question of whether you're going to end up being squeezed. Counties will be squeezed down the road as that share of their state funding that have to go to cover the children who are increasingly ineligible, kind of takes up a larger and larger share of their overall state child welfare funding. To look at the question of revenue adequacy, some of you may have heard in the short run, the LAO and the governor's estimates indicate that there's good surplus coming. There's going to be growth funding because sales tax is currently growing quite at a robust rate due to recovery from the recession. But in the longer term, nobody has really, it's hard to predict whether the revenue is going to be adequate. So just as an aside, the funding level is based on the 2010-2011 usage. So that was the amount that the legislature said, okay, we want to make sure the child welfare funding system has this level of funding. With one exception, they did create $200 million restoration of cuts that happened during the recession. So we're sort of brought up to pre-recession levels. And then the legislature effectively puts the funding on autopilot through this formula, where as sales tax and vehicle license fees grow, the funding available for child welfare growth. Well, how does the sales tax, how does this new revenue stream compare to the general fund? So I took a look at that just on the next page. And you can see here, you know, one of the challenges in trying to project this or analyze this is we don't have a good measure for the underlying need for child welfare services. So there isn't a good way to say, well, this is how many dollars we need for this system. And so what, just to give us a general idea, that the dotted line there is the growth in allegations. Now, obviously, allegations is an imperfect measure. I tried several of them, but none of them is a perfect assessment of the need. But one of the things you see here is that the growth, the beige line, or the, I guess it's beige, the brown line, is the growth in the sales tax base, the taxable sales. And so we see that, in fact, taxable sales is growing at a pretty steady clip and largely corresponding to the growth in the rate of allegations, though a little bit more volatility. In contrast, the state funding for child welfare, now this is how many funds were actually appropriated through the general fund, that growth it looks to be a little lower than the growth in taxable sales. So both of these suggest to me that going forward, you know, being connected to the sales tax revenue is not necessarily, it's not a doomsday situation, but of course it's hard to say, and in the long term, some of you know that the sales tax is eroding relative to other tax streams because of our outdated tax structure, so there's a long-term question there. But importantly, let's just remove this gray box on the next slide, and we'll see that leading up to the recession, things were looking pretty good. But then in the recession, you see that volatility in the sales tax does have an effect. So in the 08, 09, you know, 9, 10 years, the taxable sales revenue stream would have been far lower than the money that was actually appropriated through the general fund. You know, raising this issue, if your boat is tied to the sales tax revenue, you kind of sink or swim with what happens to that revenue. This raises the question of the reserve fund. So under realignment, counties have access to a reserve fund where they can set aside, I believe it's up to 10% of the growth revenue that they receive in order to prepare for that year where the sales tax revenue might dip. And there's a real question about whether counties are actually going to use that. I think most counties say, you know, I've got too many needs and I need to fund these services and we'll deal with the bad year when it happens. The preceding chart just suggests that in a time of recession, we do want to be a little cautious. So one of my recommendations is about suggesting the idea of putting a trigger on the use of the reserve fund. Now, finally, I think one of the biggest questions is the question of equity. So prior to realignment, you have the Department of Social Service uses a whole complex array of methodologies to distribute funding, including matching rates, adjustments for certain legislative priorities, for cost of living, for caseloads. And so you could think of it as our state's best guess at how to equitably distribute the money. Though, you know, obviously many will disagree whether or not it was an equitable distribution. But the point is that under realignment, the distribution that existed in 2010-11 is the distribution that's going to exist going forward. So the legislature provided no criteria for how we would adjust funds for different counties and how much they receive based on changes in demographics, changes in caseload, changes in the incidence of maltreatment, any of these other kinds of realities that counties might face. And so we really have to ask, well, you know, have we set in place a distribution while needs are shifting all around us? And to look at that, I just looked, just if you can go to the next slide, I looked just quickly at, you know, how distributions changed. This is a graph showing how the distribution of funding changed from 98-99 to 2010-11 based, and this is while we were under the matching scheme. So theoretically, we're doing our best effort to accommodate for caseload growth and other factors in the different counties. And you can see there's substantial swings. So Riverside, you know, had a large growth in the amount of funding it was receiving. This is just to pick two random examples. And you can see Santa Cruz had a decrease in the amount of funds it was receiving. The point of this is not to say whether this was equitable or not, but to note that over a 10-year period, you have a big swing in what's needed or how we used to distribute money. So how are we going to make that decision going forward? And that's something the legislature left unanswered. So, in the statute, the Department of Finance and the department, in consultation with CSAC, have the ability to adjust the allocation formula going forward. So they can add criteria to the realignment growth fund. But this is really an important area that stakeholders, counties, everyone needs to think carefully about. Do we want a politically negotiated allocation of funds, or do we want to add some criteria that are based on the, trying to assess the actual need for kids across the state? And it's a challenging question because some counties maybe are doing well under this formula and some are doing worse. As we'll see in the next segment, realignment has a, creates a benefit for counties who are able to reduce caseload. If you're a county that had done a lot of caseload reduction and already taking a lot of the low-hanging fruit prior to realignment, the level that you're locked in the 2010-11 distribution is like you kind of got penalized for doing good work early on, potentially. Whereas the county that was late to act and hasn't, taken a lot of measures to implement wraparound and otherwise try to get kids out of group homes and things like that, they're going to have an easy way to secure a lot of more flexible funding. So in the appendix to my report, there is a sketch assessment of what a formula would look like if you just used the population of children living in poverty. And you'll see it looks very different than the distribution looks today. So it's something to consider. And I don't, this is a question really for experts like you all in the field to wrestle with, but it's something that the legislature essentially punted on and we do need to address for the sake of equity. So those are two recommendations, regard to funding, adding criteria to the allocation formula, and considering the use of a trigger on the reserve account. Now, turning to county flexibility, this is really, I think, the core of realignment, and there's more in the report than I'm going to have time to go through right now, but the place I started was to look at how the marginal dollar breaks down pre- and post-realignment, to think about how has the incentive structure changed. So a lot of you are familiar with this, but one thing that stood out to me is that prior to realignment, in the pre-column, if you look at this is the third column, so it's county in the under pre-realignment, the county column, you see that the state has said to counties, we really don't want to incentivize the use of foster care because we're going to make it cost more for you. It costs you 30 cents on the dollar to fund foster care, whereas adoption assistance is only going to cost you 13 cents. But if you look post-realignment, it's an even distribution. You spend a dollar spent anywhere in child welfare is equal across the board. And so this really raises the question of how are counties going to respond now that the incentives the legislature had in place through particular programs have been removed. There are two areas I want to address quickly and then turn to the larger question of caseload reduction. If you see the boxes on the bottom right-hand side of the screen, one area to draw your attention to is the state program. So these are programs that are optional, that are funded exclusively through the state general fund. And these are, you can just see the difference where, for example, just to take the example of THP Plus, which I'm sure Amy will be happy to elaborate on, but you have pre-realignment counties paying zero marginal dollar for a dollar spent on THP Plus. Post-realignment, you're bearing the full cost. So if you're a county that either has THP Plus or you're trying to consider whether to implement that kind of a program or any of the state programs, you, in a time of budget difficulty, you have to be able to justify, well, we want to spend this dollar, even though if we spent this dollar on a federally eligible service, like case management, increasing caseload ratios in case management, you could extend your dollar twice as far because it only costs you 50 cents up there rather than the full dollar that you have to pay in a state-only program. The second area where there's an important shift in incentive has to do with the distinction between federally eligible and ineligible kids. Now, this is the green box, and this was already an issue prior to realignment, but now it really stands out that if you're a county, you want to get your dollars towards the federal match because you double the value of that dollar. So that would be an area that a county might be forced to say, "Ooh, man, how can we? What can we do about reducing the amount that we're spending on ineligible services?" Or on the flip side, how can we do a better job claiming, making sure that we are claiming as much as possible as federally eligible? So on state-only funded programs, the legislature was very concerned about this. They implemented requirements that in order to, and you can see the list of programs here that the legislature identified. I forget if this is an exhaustive list, but they were very concerned to say, we don't want to have any significant reductions in these programs without advance notice of a duly noticed meeting of the Board of Supervisors or action of the Board of Supervisors that it gives a rationale for why this reduction was necessary, and included a requirement that the state controller notify the legislature if reductions are made in these programs. So I think in terms of monitoring, the state-only funded programs we have a lot of provisions in place in realignment to make sure we know what's going on with those, given the incentive to potentially reduce there. Additionally, the CDSS annual report on realignment, which some of you may be familiar with, does give a county-by-county breakout of how much is being spent in each of these programs. So we've got a lot of resources there to keep an eye on those state-only funded programs. With regard to federally, the distinction between those who are 4E eligible and those who are not 4E eligible, on the other hand, we have very few data resources to be able to track what's happening. So as a lot of you are very familiar with the CWS-CMS, or the California Child Welfare Indicator Project, which is an amazing resource for everyone in their work in child welfare, it does not keep track of those who are 4E eligible and ineligible, because it's a case, you know, it's based on case management system, not a fiscal reporting and accounting system. But the problem is that means we don't have good measures to find out, well, is casework less intensive for 4E ineligible kids? Are they being diverted more frequently? Are outcomes changing? Now, of course, in some cases, these kinds of activities might be prohibited by law, assuming you have legal service attorneys there to find out what's going on. But we just want to recognize that when push comes to shove in budget time, when there's a budget crunch, counties have to figure out a way to balance their budget. So this is an area that I think we need additional reporting and need to focus our attention in the aftermath of realignment. Finally, now to turn to the overall issue of caseload reduction. I mean, if you're a county, the real end game is to figure out how can you reduce these mandatory expenditures, reducing caseload reducing the time that kids spend in care. Because if you can reduce your mandatory expenditures, you can free up more discretionary funds to use on all kinds of different purposes, which may be really important. It could be trying some new innovative programs, or it could be, you know, hiring more caseworkers to get your caseload ratios down. There are all kinds of needs that counties have, and to the extent that you can reduce your mandatory expenditures under realignment, you can free up that money. So I've got two scenarios here, but the incentive is really the same, which is, you know, get that mandatory box to shrink. And this is why, and I tread cautiously here, not being a practitioner or researcher in child welfare policy, but that, you know, I understand there's a long conversation in the field about how to balance child protection and family preservation, but it does seem to me that the fiscal incentive structure that's set into place in realignment is a move towards family preservation, a strong fiscal move, you know, giving a strong fiscal incentive towards family preservation in the state, and that's something we just want to be cognizant of and keep an eye on. So you all know this, of course, next few slides just go through some of the data about, well, California has been reducing caseload for the past decade. So this one is the figure 11 is just showing that caseloads, in-care rates, entries, substantiations, all have been falling. In figure 12, we see that out-of-home placement days, and you all are very familiar with the story, have been falling across the board, particularly in the area of kin and foster care. Finally, in CWS caseloads, also falling, and there it's with regard to permanency planning. And I guess the issue is that realignment assumes that this can continue, that if you're able to continue to drive down numbers, then you'll free up discretionary funds. The trouble is that if a county is in a situation where, you know, these are statewide averages, but these aren't consistent across all the counties. So some counties are seeing caseload rising, perhaps. If you're one of those counties, then you're kind of in a catch-22. You're sort of squeezed because you, in order to get the discretionary funds that enable you to do some front-end services to help reduce unnecessary long-term care, you need to be able to reduce your caseload to free up those discretionary funds. But you can't reduce your caseload if your caseload is rising due to demographics or other factors. And so this is something that we need to think about, not just at a statewide level, but at a county-by-county level to really assess that dynamic. Of course, as you all know, there are lots of potential positive and negative outcomes from cost reduction. A lot of cost reduction efforts and caseload reduction efforts may align with best practices, so the implementation of KinGap, moving people to adoption assistance, wraparound care. There are a lot of ways that reducing costs is also aligned with best outcomes. But we need to ask whether under realignment, does the the performance measurement system that we had prior to realignment, is it equipped to capture the specific kinds of actions that we expect under realignment? So I'm in the interest of time not going to go through each of these figures, but they're here for you, and there's more in the report. And obviously, you as practitioners in the field have a wealth of ideas and you know feedback about what are some of the cost reduction strategies and what the benefits or costs would be for each. But just to think about the monitoring and oversight, you all know we have AB 636. That's our performance measurement system and or process. And there's great data from the California Child Welfare Indicators Project, as well as the System Improvement Plan process, which realignment did set on a less frequent interval but with an annual report. So that annual report is something that I address in my report. I think that's an area where we could get more data and have an opportunity to see across all the counties systematically what are they what's happening in different program areas, both in terms of performance outcomes but also in terms of spending and investment in programs. With regard to fiscal reporting, realignment does create a few requirements. So if you want, if a county wants to shift funds between realignment accounts, so that's like between the mental health side and the child welfare side, there's a reporting requirement there, as well as the use of the reserve funds. So there is a reporting requirement on that. But otherwise, the legislature was pretty silent about what kinds of data or information need to be provided. The good news is that the Department of Social Services is for now requiring counties to claim in the same mechanism, so using the county expense claim form and the CA 800 for assistance, which means we are collecting the data. The question is, are we presenting it in a way that statewide stakeholders as well as those working at the county level can make use of? Finally, I think there's a need to particularly focus on mandatory spending reductions. So this idea of, you know, reducing entries, reducing time in the system, and reducing cost per case, and thinking carefully, well, do our performance measures really capture these risks? And I have an example on figure 15, which we're just going to skip over in the interest of time, but there are examples of sort of some of these cost reduction strategies. How could we monitor them using the data that's available to us, and where is it that there's a time lag or we don't have a way of measuring the outcomes? Just one example might be the use of voluntary placements, where we really don't know what happens to in terms of outcomes for kids who enter and then are voluntarily diverted rather than entering the child welfare system. Finally, you know, to think about this performance measurement challenge, again, just to sort of recap the, you know, for me, what the real takeaway is that realignment gives the county a set amount of money and says, we don't want to tell you how to spend it. We want to evaluate you on your outcomes, on your performance. But there are so many performance measurement challenges in the field of child welfare. And here we've got a few. We've got measuring abuse depends on discovering it. Outcomes are only tracked for those who enter the system and while they're in it. So that's what I was alluding to with the voluntary placements. The empirical research is not totally limited, but it's less common than in other areas of public policy. You can have simultaneous interventions. And we're just beginning to figure out how to connect data from other spheres where there are outcomes of interest that we care about, so health outcomes, mental health outcomes, educational outcomes, to be able to really have a better story over the long term about what's good for kids. And so I tried to take a few stabs in my report as a budget nerd and not a child welfare person to think about what kinds of measures could we use in child welfare to be assessing realignment. And I've got a few examples in the report. I think because I'm running low on time, I'm going to skip. I'm just going to skip to the Amy, if you don't mind skipping to the next one. In the case of caseload ratios, for example, so we CWDA frequently invokes the SB 2030 review, saying that our caseload ratios were too high in the state, and we need to invest to bring the caseload to a manageable level. Which is maybe true. There was significant investment from the state. There were some special funding streams set aside to do that, to bring down the caseload ratios. But we actually don't, you know, by and large, the department does not report on a county-by-county basis what caseload ratios are. It's not part of any of the system improvement plans that I looked at. And yet this would be one of the most basic ways to measure what's the intensity of service that we're providing. Are we providing, you know, okay, we have the number of cases that we're seeing, but how much time is each caseworker able to spend on those cases?
And I think one of the reasons that we may not do that has to do with labor relations concerns. But you really want to ask, if you just look at Figure 16, you'll see that the sort of at a basic level, you wonder, well, caseloads have been falling for the last 12 years, and yet investment in child welfare services has been, and particularly in CWS expenditures, has been increasing. So what's the story there? Maybe our caseloads have been improving as the caseload ratios, now that over the last 12 years they've been dropping. It's been a while since the 2030 workload study. And I should just note here, this one says total, the axis is total spending on child welfare, the vertical, the y-axis. But in fact, the graph looks pretty much the same when you do CWS. This is a mistake of mine, but when you do the CWS budget line specifically on CWS, and family maintenance, emergency response, and so forth, the bars look pretty much the same. So with regard to county flexibility, I think there's, my assessment is that we need to have public reporting that's really tailored to realignment. Not, yes, we have great performance measurement through the Child Welfare Indicators Project, and that's an amazing tool that we need to use. But realignment presents some very specific risks, particularly as I view it, with a fiscal incentive towards family preservation, that we need to make sure we have the tools in place to assess what's happening at the county level. The 8636 system was set into place in a different policy context, and so it's possible that some updates to those oversight mechanisms are needed. And one of the places I think where we could, I mentioned this earlier, but is in strengthening system improvement plans, particularly the annual updates. System improvement plans are based on what a county identifies as its area of, it identifies the priorities in through a process in consultation with the department as well as a peer review. But maybe in addition to letting the county pick which areas it wants to focus on improving, we should have standardized reporting as a part of that system improvement plan so we can see how resource investment is shifting across counties as a result of realignment. So then finally, just to turn to the system evolution, and here I'll again try to be brief. The basic takeaway for me is that child welfare is not on autopilot, and some in the legislature may feel like, hey, we did that, it's done, it's out of the general fund, so it's now up to the counties. But I think in contrast, the state still has authority over child welfare policy, and it still needs to monitor what's going on. One of the concerns is that now that most of child welfare funding is out of the general fund, is there that same annual process, or sometimes twice a year, public hearing process through the budget process to say, hey, what are we doing in this program? Let's have a review. Let's see how we're spending our money. Because it still is state funds that are coming down to the county. And so it's really critical that the budget hearings continue and that child welfare is a part of that process and that stakeholders continue to engage the legislature. Additionally, the CDSS annual report is a great, it's a good instrument. It's something I think the more stakeholders use, the more it can be a tool for measuring what's happening across counties. And so I have a little bit more to say about that report in my own paper as well. And then finally, the real action is now at the Board of Supervisors. So for all of you who are working at the county level, and Reed is, I know, certainly going to speak to this, there's a real challenge at now inserting yourself into your county's budget process where perhaps in the past you didn't need to be as active because you had a set of matching rate formulas at the state level saying, you spend money on this, you get reimbursed this amount. Now there's a lot more flexibility for the county. So that's a challenge. I'll let Reed speak to that, but I know that transparency and kind of the availability of information about what's happening in a county budget really varies from county to county. And so this is going to be a real challenge for stakeholders going forward. With that, I just on a couple of recommendations about what local stakeholders can do. There's engaging in the county budget process, as I mentioned, which Reed's going to address. We talked about getting involved in the system improvement plan. So one of the challenges is that if it's every 5 years, it's hard to build a sense of habit and to build momentum on staying involved in that process, but it's a vehicle that is already in statute, it's already required of counties, and it kind of is the logical place where if we want to see what our counties are doing and be measuring outcomes, the system improvement process is that vehicle. So I think it's important for folks to get acquainted with that, engage with your local Department of Children and Family Services, and to be involved. And then finally, the data that is available, we have to make sure that we use it and ask for more. So The CDSS annual report is one resource, particularly for monitoring those state-only funded programs to see what's happening in your county. And then always incorporating the Child Welfare Indicators Project, the amazing resource from out of UC Berkeley, because there for some of the risks that we've identified here for realignment, there are important data that we can use to ask questions and say, hey, what's going on here? And then finally, the importance of networks like John Burton Foundation, of course, are now even more paramount because you no longer have as much of a state venue for a lot of policymaking decisions. So to keep folks in Stanislaus and Merced and San Bernardino counties connected and knowing what developments are happening at the county level, engagement with these kind of state networks is really critical. With that, I'm going to stop there. We'll do some questions and.
Well, thank you, Isaac. I mean, if any of you have read his paper, it is very impressive that he was able to get through all of it in this period of time. And we were getting a lot of questions coming through, very good questions, very thoughtful. And so thank you for asking those. We're going to hold on them for just a few minutes while we turn it over to first Reed Cannell and then Martha Matthews. Reed and Martha are engaging in local conversations about realignment, Reed in Alameda County and Martha in LA County. So they're going to spend a few minutes talking about those efforts, and then we're going to turn back to all of your questions. And you know, if you have questions for Isaac or Martha and Reed, email them in, and we will make sure that we get to them today. So I'll turn it over to Reed.
Great. Thanks, Amy, and thank you, Isaac, for the very detailed and thoughtful effort that went into the report and into this presentation. I think to describe our effort here in Alameda County, I think that the really important kind of high-level frames that defined it were first that, we recognized very early on a lot of Alameda County advocates and providers are very engaged in state processes kind of on an ongoing basis, and so when realignment was being proposed, planned, and rolled out, we were up there attending the hearings and the Human Services Committee and speaking with legislative staffers and speaking with the administration. And I think, you got to remember that this whole, current moment of California's fiscal miracle and Jerry Brown on the front page of the New York Times, that's all really recent, right? And realignment came along when we were still very much in a crisis environment of, multi-billion dollar deficits. And in those early conversations, one thing that was recognized by a lot of the stakeholders that I work with locally was that it didn't look like there was enough money. Isaac talked a lot about the adequacy of revenue and the volatility of the revenue source. And at the time, it didn't look like there was enough money in the deal to cover all of the spending on the programs that were being realigned down to the county. And then the other thing, so that adequacy of revenue frame was really defining. And then the other was this increased flexibility. And there was a lot of talk in kind of broad brushstroke language in the proposals and in the governor's statement about this new county flexibility. And counties, of course, through their advocacy channels, CSAC and, CMHDA, CWDA, were talking a lot about flexibility. They wanted flexibility, and they wanted to make their support for realignment almost contingent on getting flexibility to manage to the adequacy of resources that were going to be provided. And this was all pre-Prop 30, right? And there were a lot of differing opinions as to whether or not Prop 30 was going to pass. And, of course, while all focus was on the revenue bump that it provided, it also wrote realignment into the Constitution. Our provider community organized really early in a time of scarcity and in a time of kind of unfinished business and unanswered questions. And so, we approached our Board of Supervisors way back in February of 2012, and our first requests to them were really for more information, that we wanted a venue and we wanted a forum and we wanted a process by which we could all collaboratively track what was going on with realignment and with the revenue streams and so on, and also think through what all the implications were going to be. And we very intentionally wanted that to be a collaboration between the CBO community, the advocacy community, the departments, and the Board of Supervisors. And so in order to kind of secure the leverage that we hoped would you know, bring this to the top of people's to-do lists, we did start by assembling a very broad coalition. Like I said in that first bullet point, it was, you know, at this point it's almost 120 CBOs that have, you know, some stake in Realign programs. And it's important to say that that's not just the child welfare side. We organized around all of 2011 realignment, so that includes the behavioral health subaccount and almost all then community mental health programs. So we have stakeholders there who have, you know, almost no stake in foster care, but are very interested in, you know, Medi-Cal managed care or substance abuse treatment programs and so on. And so I think assembling that broad coalition and having all those signatories, it really did the trick because we got a very immediate response from our board of supervisors. I think I emailed the first letter on Friday afternoon, and I got an email back from our board president on Saturday. But you know, at the time, first of all focus was on the outstanding ambiguities. Second of all, the board was really wrapped up in the AB 109 realignment. And so, if you even just said realignment, you know, even some of our board staffers would say, "Wait, you mean it's more than just jails?" So we recognized pretty early that we were going to need to engage in a fairly extensive process of kind of stakeholder education and conversation because, you know, it was going to take some work to align everybody's understanding, everybody's interpretation, and everybody's language such that we could start to actually advance these conversations about, well, what does this mean for our county and what does it mean for our planning and how do we adapt our systems and our goals to this new reality? And so we requested that the board hold formal hearings before its committees to solicit information, to kind of consolidate information from the departments. Their county lobbyists participated when they actually did hold those committees. We had the county lobbyists. We had
on my part, Reed, his audio has cut out, and so I'm sure he'll be back joining us just in a moment. If there is anyone who is able to hear him, we don't certainly want to talk over him, but we're just going to check for a moment and see if they're able to hear him or not. Okay, with that, we're going to move on to Martha. I'm sure Reed will be joining us again, and we'll get to hear more about his work in Alameda County. But Martha, thank you, Matthews from Public Counsel. Thank you for being with us and sharing some of the activities that are underway in Los Angeles County.
Hi, everybody. This is Martha. Just a quick sound check. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we've got you.
Okay, so LA County, being huge, moves very slowly. And those of us who try to, you know, organize advocates and stakeholders, often the sheer largeness of our environment tends to stymie us. And so we're actually at an earlier stage than what Reed described. But we're trying. I mean, and I think the one takeaway that I'd like to offer to everyone on the webinar is just do something in your own county, even if it feels like, you know, there's only three of us who even understand what realignment is, and we forget every time and have to read our own slides. It's you got to start the conversation somewhere. And so what we did with, you know, really no money and minimal amount of people working on it was we started by, as Reed said, first you have to give people a common vocabulary, a common set of basic concepts about what child welfare realignment is, because it's confusing. I mean, you know, when people say realignment, people think about jails or there are other things being realigned like mental health. And so child welfare realignment was not the highest profile issue while all of this was happening. So we started with doing sort of realignment 101, but because Los Angeles, like Alameda, is a waiver county, we also sort of tried to incorporate, like, okay, so how are the possible effects and possible downside risks of realignment amplified in a waiver environment, which made it more complex. And so we did kind of a less sophisticated version of what Isaac did today, for as many people as we could lure into a room by offering a free lunch in the spring of this year. And then we said to them, it was, you know, we really tried to invite everyone, you know, advocates, stakeholders, service providers who were worried about how they might be affected by this, our child welfare agency, our county mental health agency, our children's commission. You know, we just sort of called everyone and said, look, we're trying to educate ourselves about child welfare realignment. Please come. And we had a great response. But then what often happens, and I think if we had had a more sophisticated organizing strategy the way Reed described, this might not have happened quite so much, is that people are willing to show up to one meeting and be educated and to sort of like, okay, now I understand a little bit about child welfare realignment. But then the next step is like, well, you know, who would like to brainstorm on action steps and what are we going to do next? And then all of a sudden at the next meeting, 10 people show up. But we have had an ongoing working group. Everyone on the initial Realignment 101 email list has continued to sort of stay in touch by email, and we have sort of like the loyal few who show up and actually do work. And what we've done is, you know, we've tried to shift our advocacy efforts down to the County Board of Supervisors level, but in Los Angeles County, we have a really complex environment because we have the Board of Supervisors, we have our CEO's office, which also has oversight responsibility for child welfare, we have obviously our agency, the Department of Children and Family Services, and then we have a bunch of commissions. We have the Children's Commission, we have lots of commissions. Recently, as a result of yet more bad press about our child welfare system, we have a new Blue Ribbon Commission. And so what we're doing is we're trying to engage with key county leadership on county-specific decision points and recommendations. So next slide, please. I don't know how to change the slides. So here's, I mean, and we've developed a PowerPoint for that we're going to present to the Board of Supervisors and to the new Blue Ribbon Commission, basically offering county-specific recommendations on these four decision points. And if anyone's interested in our full in the presentation that we're going to make to the Board of Supervisors, I can certainly make that available. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Martha. There's a lot more that Martha and Reed have to say about this. Again, I've had a similar experience, Martha. It's interesting to put your toe into this, but these are complex issues, and it's going to take a sustained conversation of a lot of different people at the local level to think about these things. And so we're going to move on to questions and answer. And the first question, Reed is now back with us, so I want to direct it back to him. Reed, and we have a number of questions, so I want to tick through them somewhat quickly so that we can answer as many as possible. What's next for Alameda County efforts? Where are you now, and what's the activity? What do you see stakeholders in, and the stakeholder community is the county representatives, the providers, advocates, foster parents, the whole community working together. Where are you going at this point?
Right. So you got me here?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, great. So very sorry. I don't know what happened there. I just all of a sudden got a big red box on my screen. So, like I said, it took us quite a bit of time and a number of meetings and hearings to kind of get everybody on the same page and talking. But we've done that. And as everybody mentioned, Alameda County is a waiver county as well. And one of the really important pieces was of our kind of education process was to get really clear and to help the board understand what was within and without the inside and outside of the waiver. So what portion of total child welfare programs, the programs that the community experiences as foster care or as child protective services and so on, what portion of those are subject to the terms of the Title IV-E waiver, and what portion of those are now subject to the terms of under realignment? Because there, I think, you can anticipate kind of different planning processes. There are some requirements in the waiver for how planning happens and so on. And now that we've come to that understanding, we are very much continuing to try and work with the board to create an inclusive planning process, again, for all programs under realignment, whereby the community will be able to understand the issues, understand the pressures and priorities with anticipation, that is, well before the board starts to formally consider an action. And we're finding that a lot of that is delegated by the board to the departments. So while we're not as big and complex as Los Angeles, there's still a kind of complicated balance of power and responsibility that's maintained between the boards, the departments, the county auditor controller, and the CAO. And so it's looking like a lot of that planning process is going to happen in collaboration with the departments, we hope, and then that we'll be able to kind of support and be mutually supportive with eventual proposals that come forward before they get to the board, so that in cases in which we agree, we can all agree, and hopefully that helps the credibility of an action with the board or a suggestion recommendation to the board. And when we disagree, again, we can have an opportunity to have those conversations before an action has been decided.
Thanks, Reed. The next question, I think it's a comment and a question, but I'm very interested to have hear Isaac's point of view on it, is a commenter says, you know, I don't see creating permanent families for youth who've been in the system for a long time as a cost reduction strategy. California has shown leadership in this area, but locally these strategies have been underutilized, resulting in unnecessary costs and poor outcomes for youth. What are your thoughts on this?
Sure. You know, I, as I mentioned before, I'm not an expert in child welfare policy, and I think it, in general, I totally agree with you. You know, from what I know, I definitely agree with your comment, and it seems like much of, and maybe I didn't say this enough at the outset, but I think a lot of what realignment, it's kind of a fortuitous moment, because it's saying, hey, the feds aren't taking action to align fiscal incentives with what's best outcome, you know, with what we understand to be best practice, but at the state level, you know, maybe this is a good opportunity to make some of those changes to the way we finance the system. So it could be that realignment is, just as you say, is going to usher in the adoption of more best practices. So, if it's family preservation it leading to better outcomes, then that's a great development. My take on it is the question of do we have the right performance measures in place to see what happens when you add to what was already a policy priority, which is that we want to keep kids with families whenever possible and safe. You add to that a strong fiscal incentive. You just want to be able to monitor and make sure that, okay, the fiscal incentive is aligning with, continuing to align with best practice, and not sending, forcing counties to make a choice between balancing a budget and doing what they believe is safest for the kids. And so I don't have a, you know, in a way, I guess I feel like I don't have a dog in the fight about, how far can we go with caseload reduction, because it's really not my area of expertise, but what I do identify is that the fiscal environment is adding an incentive in that equation, and we want to ask if the oversight, the monitoring mechanisms, not just for the state, but for folks who are working at the county level, do we have the measures that we need, and are we able to track the outcomes that we need to understand what the effects of our the shift in our policy is as a result of these fiscal incentives.
Martha, you can you share a local point of view on that question?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's happened with LA County is that we may have reached the bottom of caseload reduction. That's kind of our fear, because Los Angeles has done fairly aggressive caseload reduction efforts for years, and now it's starting to creep back up, even in a non-recession environment. And so I think what the person who asked the question may have been about is sometimes the least expensive option is not the best option. For example, there are kids who are going to be expensive. I mean, they're going to need therapeutic foster care, or they're going to need a lot of services, or they're transition age youth who will need support to go into transitional housing and to go to college and, you know, to not just sort of like, okay, you're 18, bye. And one of the challenges that there is an incentive for the child welfare system, because it has its own little block grant, well, not little, to externalize costs. Because if you push people out of the system, you don't hear from them again. But, of course, they may show up in a very expensive way in your jails, in your adult mental health system, in your system of services for homeless people. You know, if you sort of push kids out without adequate support, or you reunify families, or you finalize adoptions without without the support that people really need. Like, okay, grandma, here's your four special needs grandchildren. Have a great time. Bye. That's going to be really expensive later, but it might be really expensive to someone other than the Department of Children and Family Services. So we have to work really hard at the county level, both to get good monitoring so we can tell if that stuff is happening, and also to get the county to take a broader view of what's expensive and not expensive, and to somehow build in safeguards against different parts of the county essentially offloading costs to each other. I hope I'm making sense.
Definitely. I mean, making sense. I think also this is Amy's making comment, in my experience having these conversations, keeping at the center of the conversation the fact that every person has the absolute best intentions. Sometimes in the conversation about realignment, as we raise concerns about unintended consequences, that can be extremely hard to hear, because who goes into a lifelong career of a largely underpaid field to have their intentions, kind of questioned? And so a real challenge at the local level is knowing and celebrating and remembering the fact that we all want the best for the children, and how we, and it's really about putting in place structures to monitor that. But from there, I want to tick back to Isaac. And you mentioned, Isaac, there's a question about the trigger. What do you mean, put a trigger on the reserve fund? What does that mean?
So that would mean, for example, that in a year where the growth exceeds, in a given year, if the growth sub-account revenues exceed the prior year by some threshold amount, that prior to being able to allocate those new funds to continued program expenditures, it's like a rainy day fund. You would fill up a rainy day fund up to a certain point. And, I recognize that this is kind of, it's one of those things that they're not very popular. Like, budget analysts love these things. Politically, they're not very popular, and people try to find sort of ways to wiggle around them. But I think it's given the potential volatility that we see in a time of deep recession for child welfare realignment, based on the analysis that I did, somebody should ask that question about how are we going to use the reserve fund. Because I think asking counties to, this is sort of anecdotal, but asking counties to do it on their own. Some counties may, those who are maybe more fiscally conservative and are very cautious about their budgets. But a lot of folks feel that, when I spoke anecdotally with folks, feel that, there's so much need out there that they worry about putting voluntarily setting funds aside, because basically another department may say, hey, those guys have that reserve. We need it for, we have all this other need over here in this other part of the county budget. Can't we access some of that? So people in general, I think, program folks have a political concern about reserve funds, and a trigger kind of takes some of that difficulty of the political decision making out, so that you can ensure that you're putting aside at least a cushion for if you do have a big drop like we saw in that earlier slide.
So another great comment that's being made, a reminder that 100% of children adopted age 10 and above are federally eligible for adoption assistance program. It goes down to age 8 in October. What's extremely important about that comment is the federal government fixed the look back for AAP, but it did not fix the look back for foster care. Now, in California, our AAP caseload is bigger than our foster care caseload. If the federal government can fix that policy for AAP, it can do it for foster care. And in some ways, the tension that Isaac's report really gets to comes down to the look back. Why are we basing whether the federal government pays a share of cost for a child in foster care on an eligibility standard from 1996? This, if that look back were fixed, it would fundamentally put our state and our counties in a much better financial position. This is something the John Burton Foundation, we want to work together as a state to make the case persuasively to our congressional delegation and to Congress as a whole, because so many of these conversations come back to eliminating the look back, or at least updating it. So from here, more questions, great questions. Here's a question. We are considering asking for a reserve fund in LA, but department officials aren't agreeing because they say if there are funds left over, they will be used by other county departments at the end of the year. How do we safeguard the funds? Martha, can I ask you to maybe comment on that? Again, there's no single answer, but as someone working in LA County, do you have any thoughts you'd like to share?
I don't, because I'm not a fiscal person, but I think the process, that whoever that person is who asked the question, come join our realignment working group, because what we want to do is to ask the Board of Supervisors and the CEO's office exactly that question, like, how do you get a reserve and protect it from being raided? That's exactly the sort of conversation that should be happening at the Board of Supervisors level.
Great. Isaac, did you want to add anything? You were kind of making a motion there.
I think just to note that the language in the statute from SB 1020 indicates that the reserve account, you know, there are restrictions on what you can do with the reserve account. So there was a fear I heard in talking to some analysts and advocates early on that a county could, you know, those who were if you used a reserve fund, then you would be able to draw down the money and spend it on something else. You know, it's like that's a way to get money out of child welfare sub-account into other county priorities. But it seems to me that the government code would prohibit that. So maybe that's maybe a question for a county attorney to address. But I think that the legislature put good protections in on that. I should also note, you know, on a similar note, that the realignment sub-account, for those who aren't aware, there is a floor that the legislature put in place. So a county has to spend at least as much as they spent in 2010-11 in child welfare services to avoid a penalty. So it's not, you know, there were fears when I talked to people, what's going to prevent a county from shoveling this money out to law enforcement or some other place? And those kind of transfers are really, I think, unlikely to happen based on the structure that was put in place.
Thanks, Isaac. A comment. At the beginning of the presentation, you referred to this as a block grant, but a block grant is fixed, and realignment fluctuates with the sales and use tax. So could you please clarify?
Yeah, thanks for that question. That's what I called my bluff. I mean, it's not actually a block grant specifically, but it's I use that as a kind of analogy that people are often familiar with, which is to say you have a fixed – you have a set of money that you then get to spend as you please. So it's correct that each year the revenue stream will grow or, you know, potentially shrink, and it's not an allocation that's being determined by the legislature through the granting process. But the policy concerns and the incentive concerns are the same idea, which is you know how much money you're going to get, and then you get to spend it. There's no, sort of, this may be the wrong expression, but there's no strings attached in how that's not to that level, but I just mean you have flexibility in how you spend it. You don't have to spend it because you're not having a matching rate. You don't have to make sure you're claiming each dollar spent.
Next question is about the criteria regarding equity. What are the ones that are recommended that are included in your report? You refer to it in the appendix, but could you briefly speak to that?
Sure. Thanks for that question. So, you know, I did this. I did a quick sketch of what it would look like if you took the total child welfare realignment account distribution, and I did the total rather than the thing that the Department of Finance and the governor have control over is the growth funds going forward. So it's not just they can't just change the total distribution, but I did it just to see how different would things look at the end of the day if you did this for, you know, 10 or 15 years and really let things settle. I used the population of children in poverty, and I adjusted it by living expenses just to see, you know, so you would say, well, we don't know, you know, is it allegations, is it substantiations, is it, are there, you know, what are prosecutions, like what is the factor that we should use to measure the need for child welfare services? And in my consultation with researchers in the field, it seemed like the best, there's no good single measure, and the thing that comes closest are basic demographics, population and maybe children living in poverty, or the poverty rate. And so that was why I chose children living in poverty. But I think, you know, this is a great area for researchers in the field to figure out, are there some simple measures that the legislature or that the department could be using, Department of Finance could be using, to provide some rational basis for how the funds are distributed. I would just add that the LAO, in their analysis of, if you look at their analysis of 1991 realignment, there's a nice little blurb about how there were some efforts to impose these kinds of
equity criteria for future growth in the funds, but that they never quite got off the ground. And so it's like this, in a way we're having the same discussion all over again.
Just to elaborate on that and just to clarify with people, we're going to take a couple more questions and we will wrap up. I'm not understanding why certain counties would be winners or losers if we change these criteria. Please help me understand.
So the way that funds were distributed in 2010-11, which is the base for the allocation between counties, has to do with the amount that those counties were getting. And there's a lot of reason why there's variation between counties. In some cases, one example is like specialized care increments. So if your county used specialized care increments intensively, your total budget for foster care may have been, you could debate about, you know, whether they actually saved money because of you know, diverting people from group homes, but your budget may have been higher than it would have been if you weren't using specialized care increments, because the amount going per child would be higher. And so for a whole variety of reasons, the distributions that were going to each county in 10-11 were not, there isn't some even distribution per child or per substantiation or per case or anything like that. It had to do with this accumulation of, I think it's over 130 funding methodologies if you look at the department's annual local assistance methodologies. And realignment takes away all of those, and it just says, well, whatever share of the total pot you had in 2010-11, that's the share you'll get going forward.
Thanks, Isaac. Just a couple more questions. I'm familiar with the SIP, but what's the annual report? How is it used at the local level, and how are stakeholders engaged?
So I think maybe the clarification question. There are sort of, I mentioned two different annual reports. I think so. The SIP, there's the annual update to the SIP. So that's part of the SIP process. So that's one piece where I think the department could be requesting that counties provide some baseline, some additional baseline data, fiscal program data, those kinds of measures. In addition to, because the SIP only, as a five-year report, it only really provides measures on the areas that the county has elected for improvement. But the annual report would be the annual update to the SIP would be one vehicle to have kind of systematic county-by-county reporting. The second item is the annual report from the Department of Social Services to the legislature. That's required by statute, and it's available at the end of the PowerPoint. There's a resources slide that goes to the CDSS realignment page, and you can find the report there. And the department has mentioned they see this as version 1.0, so they're looking for input about how the report can, you know, what information is needed, what additional information can be in there. So take a look there. I mean, I think my general take on it is it kind of packages the data that was already available through the Child Welfare Indicators Project and sort of is a guide to how to read that, but there's no realignment-specific reporting in that annual report to the legislature.
Okay. Last question, we'll take kind of question, comment. How would you move away from the look-back drop eligibility altogether, go with TANF instead of AFDC? Our research at the Chronicle of Social Change indicates that California would benefit if we switch to TANF, but other states that use TANF would potentially decrease the number of eligible children. And I think that highlights the complexity of this question. Many think it should be removed altogether. Others believe that that isn't politically likely, and therefore some type of update is the appropriate approach. And then there are others who want to bring even different approaches into the conversation. But I think, you know, as we get farther away from 1996, a smaller and smaller share of our caseload is covered, both in California and nationally. And it gets harder and harder to make the change because more time has gone by and the cost of making that change is getting higher and higher. And so it really speaks to the need to move sooner rather than later because, you know, again, as more time goes by, making that change and bringing all of these children who are now in California being paid for 100% by counties back into the federal fold, it's an expensive proposition. So we don't have the answer, but we do want to be part of the conversation. And I want to thank Isaac. You know, Isaac has finished graduate school, started a new job, and, you know, has taken the time to put together this presentation and be here. So thank you very much for participating. Thank you, Martha and Reed, for participating. And also, you know, the information that is in ISAC's report was collected in close consultation with the counties and the Department of Social Services. And so we're fortunate to have, you know, public sector partners who are thinking very hard about this and working very hard to maintain what is a strong child welfare system in California. You know, sometimes when we're in it, we have no problem criticizing it. But when it's held up against other states, we have a lot that's going right here in California. So with that, thank you again for your participation today. Today's web seminar will be recorded and posted at the THP Plus website along with ISAC's paper. Have a good day.